Welcome back to a special Tuesday edition of the High Percentage Podcast. Why didn't you get this on Sunday? Because I messed up. I had a friend coming over, an old-time friend, to stay with us on Sunday night, and I was really busy, you know, writing during the day because writing is sort of how I make my money. And I was trying to like write extra to catch up for the fact that I'd be missing time. And it was like 7 o'clock, and I looked up. I was like, "Shit, the podcast!" So hopefully that won't happen again. But I'm releasing an episode today to kind of make up for it. And today we're going to talk about two things. One is the new study that I am obsessing over, and then after that, I want to talk a little bit about a quote from one of my favorite jiu-jitsu thinkers and philosophers, John Danaher. Okay, so right now, we are in the midst of our largest study we've ever done for High Percentage, and we're releasing it in little snippets. You've already gotten two of the five pieces of it, which is, this started with an idea. I'm actually going to give credit. So I know a guy, his name's Kane, and I trained with him in Monterey. Great guy, good teacher, former wrestler, and I think he's like the wrestling coach at one of the high schools over in Salinas or something. And he was like, "Hey, you should do a study where you mark the time of all the submissions so that we see when they happen." And I was like, "Yeah, that's a good idea." So we did 100, and that was an article I published 2 or 3 weeks ago at this point, and it was all white belts. It was half gi, half no gi. And then I just was like, well, let's keep it going. Let's go and do blue belts next. So we did 100 more. So we're sitting at 200. And I really got excited when I started looking at the data combining the white and the blue belts, because it was this perfect blend where there were some things that were very consistent between the two belt levels, but there were other things that were very different. And there were also things that were different between gi and no gi. And the other reason I got really excited about this study is because it's actually very easy to do. There's only a couple data points. You mark when the submission happens, subtract any time from the beginning of the match where, you know, before it started. You mark what the submission was, and then the belt and whether it was gi or no gi. So all those are pretty easy. The team can do it in just a few hours, and we're going to do the whole thing. So I'm really excited about this. We're going to have 500 matches. We're going to track all the submissions. We're going to time track them. I'm going to be doing scatter charts and shit. I'm actually super pumped about stuff like that. And I think it could be really useful information. But I am asking for the help of anyone listening to this, which is, you know, tell me what else you guys want to see, guys and girls, because some of the best suggestions I've gotten have been from people that have listened to the podcast or who have, you know, read stuff on the website. And you know, I get so much in my funnel sometimes that someone will suggest a really simple idea that I just hadn't thought of before, I hadn't seen before. And that's a point where I'm at now. Like, we're starting to plan the studies a little bit farther out, and I want help. Some of the areas I really want to explore is I do want to explore more no-gi, especially for white and blue belts. And I even want to explore how we can do studies that compare the points versus submission-only tournaments, because I do think it's a very different strategy that kind of emerges from those, and I'm thinking of ways that we can kind of quantify that through data. We're going to have probably the results of our 500 up next week, but we'll probably just do purple or maybe purple and brown. I want to give all of us enough time to get all that information and digest it and do a good write-up of it. But until then, we're going to start with, okay, how are purple belts comparing to blue and white belts? And I'm super psyched about it. Okay, so I kind of refer in my mind to John Danaher as the philosopher king of jiu-jitsu, because he is kind of the closest thing we have to one of the great philosophers in jiu-jitsu. And I don't mean any disrespect if there's other great ones out there, but, you know, he is kind of the brand name of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and he has earned that right because he's extremely intelligent and he's a very good communicator. And as such, I, like many people, read his Instagram religiously, and it provides you know, a little bit of nightly thought before I go to bed about something that he says, and it makes me think about something I encounter during training. And with High Percentage, I think of what we can do to stand out and serve people that practice Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in a couple ways. One, and the biggest one, is the statistics that we provide. You know, that's the real value. Second is the game theory stuff, because that gives us a way to sort of interpret the statistics instead of it just being just a wall of math that kind of confuses people. And then the third is about the theory of learning, because the way that we teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has probably changed a lot less than you would think in a couple, you know, several decades, you know, maybe 100 years at this point. 1920s, I think, is about when it started, but let's just say several decades. We are starting to get more modern training methodologies, and I think that should be informed by sort of educational theories. And if you've listened to this podcast, you know, I've worked for over 10 years in higher education, so I think about those things a lot. In my mind, and we're going to take a little bit of a history detour here, but one of the greatest innovations in martial arts history was the introduction of judo. And it's a similar story. The gentleman that created judo, Kano Sensei, he also came from a higher education background. He worked at universities or schools, and he took very, very old school Japanese jiu-jitsu, which was still kind of rooted in the old samurai kill or be killed mindset. And he said, hey, why don't we teach martial arts like we teach school children in an organized way? Like, why don't we have a curriculum? You know, the things we take for granted nowadays of, you know, your instructor giving you a piece of paper and saying, here's some of the stuff I want you to learn from white to blue belt. You know, there was a time when that didn't exist. And Kano Sensei was kind of credited as making the first push to develop a standardized curriculum. And he even pushed for a belt system, which is now, you know, pretty standard in martial arts. So I always think of that example of how he fused an industry with martial arts and it came out better for it. And I think about what we can do at High Percentage, which is, one, we can bring education into it, but more importantly, we can fuse modern ideas like data analytics with Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and see if we can come out better for it. And when I read John Donaher, sometimes I think he's thinking about the same thing. Of course, I get tremendously insecure when I read him, because I don't want him to say something that contradicts something that maybe I've said on the podcast, because a tie always will go to John Donaher. Fortunately, he doesn't do that often. Some of the stuff he says, I think, complements what we found with High Percentage quite well. And I'm going to give you an example. A debate that we hear a lot in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is this idea of concepts versus techniques. And a big buzzword that you'll hear a lot of instructors brag about is, well, I have a concepts-based approach, not a technique-based approach. But it's a buzzword for a reason. And John Donaher spelled it out really good in one of his Instagram posts, and I saved it right here. I always felt that guard retention was probably the most poorly taught subject matter in jiu-jitsu. Too often, people with excellent guard retention are seen as physically talented, as though physical attributes were the main reason why they were good at guard retention, rather than having a sound game plan and set of skills, tactics, and knowledge that made them effective. So what can we do to improve this situation? I believe the first big step in the right direction is to begin teaching guard retention in a way that reflects the way the game is actually played. Guard passing is among the fastest and most dynamic aspects of BJJ. There are constant feigns, push, pull action, reaction movements, switching sides, combining attacks, etc. In this fast-moving atmosphere where you can go from being safe and comfortable and then 1 second later be in total crisis mode with an opponent almost past your guard, it pays to have a guard retention methodology that reflects this dynamic nature. As such, I greatly favor a conceptual approach that gives useful, broadly applicable rules of behavior in response to guard-passing threats that are loose and flexible enough to be workable in fast-changing situations and chaotic situations. This is a big topic I will be coming back to quite often, because it will determine how successful you are in the bottom positions on the mat. So, one, he was correct. I have noticed that he repeatedly mentions this idea, and it relates to the way the human mind works, which is that there are some areas of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu where it pays to have a very technique-heavy methodology. And I think maybe one of those is something like back attacks or something like the mount, because those are positions that they are maybe a little bit low in how dynamic they are, and it's okay to move slower paced. And in fact, they naturally tend to move slower pace. But guard passing is not one of those positions. This is something that we've talked about before on High Percentage in a different way when we had our podcast episode about sequential games. And back then, I made the point that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu is the kind of game that does not favor in-match decision-making because it happens at too fast a pace. And essentially, the human brain in most cases cannot think fast enough to think to keep up with the fast pace of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Now, that's not always true. Like I said before, when someone is exhausted and you're on top of them in mount and they're not using as much explosive energy to resist you, then the game has slowed to a pace where you can make those quick decision makings and adjust your strategies on the fly. But when you're in an open guard position and someone's trying to do a standing guard pass, what Donaher is saying is essentially they're going to be too dynamic. They're not going to stick with a singular guard attack. They're going to be switching their attacks quite often, moving around too fast. And essentially, if you're trying to think of what technique they're doing and what is the proper technique to counter it, that's not going to be a good strategy because they're going to be moving faster than you can think, essentially. That's where the idea of a concepts-based approach comes in, which is instead of thinking about what your opponent is actually doing in that specific moment, you're more like just following a set of rules that you've trained over and over again. And that leads to an important part that we've even mentioned in our Gold BJJ Online course, which is that the planning needs to come in the day-to-day training. Once the match starts, you should more or less be on autopilot. That's why your coach is important. They'll be calling out sort of those on-the-fly adjustments, but devoid of any adjustments that you need to make in the mid-match, you should be following your plan, and you should be doing it kind of robotically because you've trained it a lot in the gym, and your plan is very specific. You want a certain takedown, you want a certain guard pass to get to an endgame position, and then you want to control and submit them from there. Bringing this back to the idea of education and the theory of learning, there is a really clear parallel here, which is this is the classic example of memorization versus understanding. In the 80s and much of the 90s, one of the sort of predominant theories in K-12 education revolved around memorization. I know when I was a child in the 90s, the way that I learned multiplication was I had these things called times tables, and you had to memorize, okay, 6 times 3 is 18. And you didn't really necessarily know why 6 times 3 was 18. You just knew that was the answer. And essentially, you would memorize, 100 of these timetables and get to a point, hopefully you could recall them from memory. And that wasn't just in mathematics. If you look at a lot of the tests from that time period and a lot of the teaching styles, a lot of it was sort of like the lecture format, especially at the high school level and the college level, where someone would lecture, you were expected to take notes. And then the tests were kind of designed to push you to recall that. And essentially, the theory of learning revolved around making you memorize something. But eventually, really smart people figured out that that is not optimal because you end up not understanding something, you've merely memorized it. The classic example here is cramming before the test. Everyone has done this. It's the night before the test. You don't know the material, but you know that there's a decent shot you could just raw memorize it, and you turn your brain into a hard drive and dump as much of that stuff as you can and then hopefully do well on the test. But we all know that 2 days later, you're not going to remember because memorization is something that has to be done constantly, otherwise it's lost. And the other thing they've figured out about memorization is that it tends to fail under pressure. Okay, so here's the bottom line with all this. You do not want to have a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu game that revolves around techniques because techniques require a couple things. One is they require memory. Two is they require recognition. And three is they require cognitive speed. And all of those things under pressure don't perform as well. This idea is probably the most true in the area of guard passing and guard retention because it is the fastest and most dynamic part of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'll admit, when I take someone's back, I go into a technique mindset, which is I think about the first technique that I want. And then if that fails, I've started thinking about the second and the third technique that I want. But that's a habit that I need to drop and instead think about how things work, develop a really deep intrinsic understanding of them, and I'll do better under pressure, even under the pressure of sparring every day in the gym. That's all for this podcast. If you want to check out all the articles that we've published over on the website, you can go to highpercentagemartialarts.com. If you want to get in contact with us, I'm at highpercentagemartialarts@gmail.com. We also have a Facebook page where we update with all of our articles, our podcasts, and I even do a Facebook Live once a week where we watch tournaments and matches in real time and do some of the data recording so you can get a little insight into our process. I should mention that if you want to keep track with other projects that I'm involved in, I'm the managing editor of a great website called ujujitsu.com. I write articles on there, and also I help corral the other writers. We try to put out quality content every week. And I've also written a book called The True Believers. It's available on Amazon. You can just Google The True Believers, Lewis Martin. It's kind of a biography of my early martial arts training in Monterey. Check that out. Thank you for listening to this, and we'll see you next week on the High Percentage Podcast.